So, last time round, we introduced our study of Esther. We talked about the way that the Jewish people have loved the book of Esther over time. And what we wanted to look at this year is the question of why it is that we love Esther. What is it that is so fascinating, and not just fascinating, but really beloved about this book? And I appreciate the people who answered my email when I asked in follow-up last week for, you know, what it is that you love about the book of Esther. Thank you very much for sending your comments about what you're looking for this year. And I think that's going to help inform the way we go with it. So we started out with history. We talked about who the Persians were. We identified potentially Ahasuerus with the king whose name is written X-E-R-X-E-S, Xerxes. So we went through that, a little bit of a history that relates to that. And we talked about the status of the Jews at this point, how Cyrus sent the Jews back. Some Jews went back, but the rest of them remain in exile. And this is really a book about them. This is a book about an exile experience. It's not a book about life in Israel. And that was very important in the theme that we're going to find ourselves coming back to consistently. I want to note that, first of all, the series is dedicated by Dana and Ilan Rubinstein, but this session in particular is associated with the following gifts from our Day of Giving, from Katie Corman, from Leah and Moish Karolnik, and from Alon Cronenberg. Okay, so we started last time, at the end of the class last time, we started talking about the themes of this book. And what I said at the time is that there are national themes here, and there are also just human themes. And the first national theme that we outlined is of exile, the experience of a nation existing in exile. And if you look at your sheet at source number one, we referenced this already at the end last time. We're just getting a running start. And it's a passage in the Talmud speaking about a verse when Esther is in the pre-harem, before she goes to Ahasuerus. And we're told that she is given things that are different, vayishaneha. She's given things that are different for the good. And we didn't know exactly what that meant. And in the passage in the Talmud here, in source number one, a passage we may come back to at some point in the book itself, but Rav said, he gave her ma'achal Yehudi. He gave her, the person in charge of the women there, gave her Jewish food. Shmuel says, no, he gave her kadli dechaziri, the necks of pigs. There is an alternate explanation of kadli dechaziri that makes it more benign. But I think keeping it in what seems to be the literal is actually important here, to understand that what it means is that either, according to one view, Esther is in exile and yet she's able to get Jewish food, or alternatively, no, Esther is in exile and she's out of luck. And then you have Rabbi Yochanan who says, she just got by. She had seeds. She ate seeds. And that's a passage I want to talk about in terms of the association with Daniel, just not going to be right now. But my point here is simply that we're getting a description of what it's like to be at the mercy of the government of the land when you are a minority. That's really what this comes down to. And different views of how Esther, in particular, managed that, how she navigated it. There's also the exile aspect of your relationship with God when you're in exile. So that if you take a look at source number two, this is also a classic. Today I want to talk about Ahasuerus' feast. If you take a look at source number two, you find a classic passage in the Talmud in which Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai alleges that the Jews of that time, of the Purim story, ate at the feast of Ahasuerus. Now, what's so terrible about eating at the feast of Ahasuerus? It's not about kosher food. No, not about kosher food.
You said about drink?
So, could be about drink. Could be about drink. But
it being a little too much into the galut that we're in.
right? You're celebrating at the feast of this Persian king. And especially what we're going to see, I hope, later today, is the idea that the feast is meant to celebrate the captivity of the Jews. So you are eating at a feast that celebrates your exile. Now, again, we have to talk about that idea. Where does the Medrash get that idea? We're going to talk that through. But this is meant to speak about the Jews' identity in exile and something that we have to wrestle with in the course of the book. Another example of that is in source number 3, which is a Medrash related to a passage at the end of the book of Esther. If you take a look, the text in source number 3 in the Talmud is really talking about receiving the Torah at Sinai. And it says, this is from the Chumash, they stood at the bottom of the mountain, and the Talmud says, oh, they stood at the bottom of the mountain. The text in Hebrew is Vayityatzvu betachtit ha'har. That doesn't sound like at the base of the mountain, it sounds like they are actually under the mountain. And the Talmud says, yeah, God says to them, here's the deal. I'm holding the mountain over your head, and you can choose to accept the Torah if you like, or you can choose to accept the mountain if you like. And the Jews wisely say, we'll take the Torah. And that way they get to live another day. But the comment there in the passage in source number 3 from Rabbi Acha bar Yaakov is, well, then you're not obligated to keep the Torah, because you were forced to accept it. Right? You accepted it under duress. To which the sage Rava responds in the last bit of source number 3. He says, yeah, however, the Jews accepted it voluntarily after they survived the threat of Haman. Because the Megillah is going to say, Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim, the Jews upheld and accepted this Torah. They accepted that which they had accepted originally at Sinai. Point being that when you're doing well in exile, when things work out, then you draw closer to God. And again, a theme we're going to look at, but I'm just trying to show you how the dynamics of existence in exile figure into different parts of the story, both when we're suffering and when things get better. Is that somewhat clear? I know I'm rushing a little bit because I'm trying to wrap up from last week, but is that somewhat clear? We good? Right, and that's part of the up and down experience, including eating at Achashverosh's meal. Right? You could envision Jews in many different generations in exile being ecstatic the king invited me to his meal. Right?
It's strange that you said that when things get good, people get closer to God, because I think even when you go through, the Bible, you see that when they get into the land, when things get good, people forget.
Right. So I think there's a sweet spot there, right after things were bad and they just got good, where you're grateful that things just got good, and then afterwards you're right, then it goes bad. But they're in that point where they can remember being under threat. And now they're just happy I'm no longer under threat. But you're right. I think that was where Janine was going with it also. Well, the Talmud doesn't bring Kimu v'Kiblu as the reason for it to be there, though.
No, the MLA. Yeah.
Right. So it's not used as a basis. I mean, there's a lot more to be said about that Midrash as a basis, in terms of what the basis for the Midrash is in the text, and God willing, if we get to chapter 9 and we're still, able to do Esther in a serious way by then and not already fallen victim to Susan's prediction that we're going to be on Esther for the next 2 years, then we'll be able to discuss the Medrash at greater length. But my only point in bringing it right now is just to show you that the book of Esther is looking at the Jewish exile experience when things are bad, as well as when things are good. The other side of this, in terms of national themes, is the idea that God's hand is actually organizing, orchestrating, and running events that take place invisibly, because, again, we never say in the text, God did this, but nonetheless miraculously. And that's certainly the way that the sages classically looked at the book. And I brought you source number 4 to demonstrate that. It's in a passage dealing with dream interpretation. And you know that the general view expressed in the Talmud in the last chapter in Brachot is that dreams are psychological phenomena and not to be interpreted as prophetic messages. Even if there are prophetic messages, they're embedded way too deeply to be grasped. Nonetheless, there is a strong view there that says that you can read things into the imagery you perceive, whether because this is truly prophetic or whether because you seize upon things as positive, and that way it will play out in a positive way because of the way you respond to the dream. So whether it's psychological or whether it is prophetic, look at the following passage. And I think I read it aloud last time, so I'm not going to really go through it in great depth this time. But it's talking about if you have a dream and you see a book from Tanakh, what you should think. And we said if you see the book of Tehillim of Psalms, anticipate piety. If you see Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, anticipate piety, because those are the theme. Piety is the theme in those books. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, wisdom. It's nice that he says that instead of boredom. Wisdom. Job and Lamentations, oh boy, suffering. One who sees the book of Esther, nes nasa lo. It's a message that a miracle has been done for him. And my point in bringing it is just to say that the book of Esther represents miracles. Which is very funny when you think about it. Among all the books in Tanakh, there are loads of books that have miracles in them. And in the book of Esther, we never say this happened as a miracle. There's nowhere in the book that anything is described that way. But that's the way it's read. And here I call your attention to something which some of you have been in classes with me for the book of Shoftim, and I've said this there. Esther is the opposite of the book of Shoftim. Meaning, Shoftim, the book of Judges, right? It hides human motivation and emphasizes instead God manipulating leaders, God manipulating nations. So that it's very rare in the book of Shoftim, in the book of Judges, for us to be told a nation invaded because there was a famine, because there had been a war. Like, you don't get that. Instead, what you get is the Jews sinned, God was upset, God sold them to such and such a nation. God caused this nation to cross the Jordan and invade. I think only in the case of Ammon, in Perek Yud in Shoftim, are we told what Ammon thinks they're attacking for. Ammon thinks they're attacking because the Jews came through 300 years earlier and took their land. That's what Ammon says. Hey, we're upset you took our land 300 years ago. And Yiftach says, that was 300 years ago, pal. But that's the story there in that one place. But other than that, it's God brought this enemy against them. It's all about God manipulating things. Whereas in Esther, you're looking at events that frankly take place at the end of the period of Nevuah, at the end of the period of prophecy, when we can't know what God intended and what God was actually manipulating. And the book describes events as we see them. It describes events without saying, and God did this. So we don't know which things God had to alter and shift and change in order to make things happen. If the book of Esther described events that took place in Shoftim, then it might have said something like, And then God put it into the heart of Achashverosh to choose Esther. Or God angered Bigtan and Teresh to make them attack Achashverosh. Or God caused Achashverosh to be unable to sleep. Right? If Esther were written in Shoftim, it would be, and God did this, and God did this, and God did this. If Shoftim were written in Esther, then it would say, and the people of Midian, led by such and such a king, grew hungry and noticed that there was good produce growing in the land of Israel and said, hey, we want to take that. And the nation of Moab saw that the Jews had succeeded in settling themselves in the land and said, hey, that's a neat trick. We want to try that too. Right? That's how it would have been recorded. You follow what I'm saying here? It's a different style.
Isn't that what makes it such a good style book? Book of Galut?
Yes, that's my point. Is that the two go together. The exile theme, you're right, and the theme of the divine hand being invisible, but being miraculously present, which is not really something I would have thought of during exile. Ruchama, you were going to say?
Yeah, absolutely. Even though God's name is not there, it's very clear that everything happened with the hand of God. By accident, this happened, this, and by accident, this happened, and this happened, by accident. So it's clear that God managed the whole thing, and even though his name is not there. On what you are talking now, if I can just go, why is it called Purim?
Right, so we're going to get to that, but not anytime soon.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a good question, but not anytime soon. We'll get there. God willing, we'll get there. Susan, you were going to ask? Wait, there are two Susans who both unmuted. Susan Brandes and then Susan Pearl. Yeah. Sorry, I can't hear you, Susan. Susan B. You're not muted. Nope, now you are muted. Now you're unmuted. But I still don't hear you. All right, sorry. Susan Pearl.
We interpreted that God had this in that, was running it behind the scenes. Is that strictly a Jewish view?
So, I'm not sure what you mean when you ask, is it strictly a Jewish view, but this I will say. There are sentences in the text that make it more clear that this is meant to be God, and there are sentences in the text that make it less clear. An example of a text that makes it more clear is the Jews fasting and praying for 3 days, and then Esther goes to Achashverosh, and he is wowed by her instead of saying off with her head. The fact that you directly link it with 3 days of fasting and prayer suggests that. The fact that that we're told Achashverosh can't sleep randomly, you know, is odd. Less odd is something like Bigtan and Teresh plotting against the king, because that happened probably every other day. That's something you look less at and say, well, that's a divine intervention. Well, it's the opposite of Yosef's story, right? In Yosef's story, they had been sent off to jail, and at least one of them was actually a good guy. It's the flip side of Yosef's story. You could argue it's a satire on Yosef's story even. But other themes within this book, we talk about national themes. There are also human themes in this book. The human hunger for power and respect is huge in this story. We're going to spend a lot of time on this one. If you take a look at source number 5, this is a classic, which we're going to come back to a little bit later, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it now, but I want to at least mention it. The source number 5, this is the one they teach you in very early on, like kindergarten. If you go to day school, you're hearing this one in kindergarten, except they only teach you like half of it, right? They teach you that Achashverosh was a very foolish king. I think they teach you that in kindergarten in order to make you less afraid of the story. You know, it's sort of, it's funny, he's foolish, he's less of a threat, right? As opposed to, you know, no, this is a horrible villain who's out to destroy us all. But look at the full passage here in the Gemara. Uvimlos hayamim ha'ela. Remember the story. We're going to talk about the story a little more in a bit. But Ahasuerus first throws a six-month party for the leadership of all of his lands. At some point during the 6 months, all of the leaders have to make it to his party. And then he has a 1 week party for the locals. So the Talmud has a debate about that, about this whole first party, second party thing. I'm using my English translation. You can read the authentic original as well. Rav and Shmuel debated. One said he was a wise king. The other said he was a foolish king. The one who said he was a wise king said he did well, drawing near the distant first. He could always appease the residents of his city. Play to your base after you've already won everybody else over. Take care of all the leaders from all around the empire. Make sure you've satisfied them, and then have a party for the base. The one who said he was foolish said no, that was a mistake. He should have drawn the residents of his city near first. For if the others would rebel, these would stand with him. You're relying on these people as your defense. You better make sure you satisfy them first. So leave aside the logic here on either side of this. I want to come back to this, Gemara, when we actually talk about the party. What I want to show you here is that Ahasuerus is a schemer. In other words, it wasn't random, hey, let's make big parties. First we'll invite all the leaders, then we'll invite all the locals because I just want my party to keep on going. No. He has a plan. His plan is to shore up support. His plan is to demonstrate his power. That's what Ahasuerus is trying to do. And either he's doing it well or he's doing it poorly. But make no mistake, his story is a story about somebody who is afraid. And somebody who thinks that he needs to find a way to impress everybody and win everybody over in order to shield himself. That's a human theme that's throughout this book of Esther. And then the other, going along with that, is the neurosis of Ahasuerus and Haman on the one side versus the emunah, the faith of Esther and Mordechai. The fact that Haman and Ahasuerus are portrayed as being incredibly insecure, right? Oh no, honey, look what happened to me today. There was one guy who didn't bow down to me. Oh, you should hang him on a tree. And make sure it's a really tall one, right? Like, I mean, what planet do people talk that way? But the answer is planet insecurity. This is a guy who just can't, I mean, I know what planet. Don't, no one say it, okay? Thank you. But that's the issue here is he's just so insecure versus Esther and Mordechai who have this complete faith, right? Esther gets a pep talk from Mordechai, fine, but she's the one who goes to Ahasuerus, carries out her plan, believing this is going to work out. Take a look, please, at source number 6, where I wanted to highlight this for you. From the way the Gemara reads the verses in which Haman speaks to Ahasuerus about the Jews. He says, and their law, he's describing the Jews, their law is different from that of any other nation. What does that mean? Well, they don't eat our food. They don't marry any of us. They won't marry theirs off to us. They don't practice the king's laws. They spend the entire year saying, today is Shabbos, today is Pesach. By which he means we don't go to work, right? Every day is a Jewish holiday and they never end up going to work. It's not worthwhile for the king to let them be. They eat and drink and mock the throne. And even if a fly would fall into the cup of one of them, he would throw out the fly and drink it. But if my master, the king, would touch the cup of one of them, he would throw it on the ground and he wouldn't drink it. Now, where the Gemara sees this in the verses, how did you get the idea that this was the that this is what Haman was actually saying to Ahasuerus is something I want to come back to when we get to chapter three, when he actually makes the pitch to him. Because there's an awful lot to say about this, but my point is only that this is a theme that the rabbis see in the book as a whole.
I think that it shows also that they were afraid from the Jews. Not only that they hated them, but they were afraid. When he said, "Am Echad," that they are really meuchadim, they are really united. No matter what they are going through, there is Am Echad, and this is something that they were afraid of also. They hated, but they were scared from them.
You know, it's a beautiful idea. I hope it's true.
Well, to me, it looks like that's what he meant, you know, when he told the... you see, Ahasuerus could not do any decision by itself.
Right.
He was an idiot, to my opinion. He could not do any decision by itself. He had to ask somebody and to do it with him.
Right. I don't think that's a function of brain power. I think that's a function of his personality. But we'll see. We're going to talk more. We have a lot more to say about Ahasuerus. I want to do one last introductory item. I want to deal with this more in chapter 9, but at least to mention it, which is the question of who wrote the book of Esther. The book itself is unclear. If you take a look at chapter 9, sentence 29 in the book. So we're flipping to the end of the Sefer. After all the action. Okay, chapter 9, sentence 29. And Esther the queen, daughter of Avichayil, and Mordechai the Yehudi, recorded as Kol Tokef, all of the strength, and I don't know what that means, to uphold this letter of Purim the second. Now, does that mean that they wrote down the book of Esther? Is that referring to recording the book of Esther? Rebecca shakes her head no.
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Definitely not necessarily.
Right. I think that's a fair statement. Certainly not necessarily, and I think it's unlikely. Because in the context, we're talking about letters that had been sent to people letting them know, hey, observe Purim. And that's certainly the way it plays out in the ensuing psukim, in the ensuing verses, that it's about observing Purim. The Gemara certainly doesn't think that Esther wrote the book. If you take a look at source number 7 on your sheets, the Talmud in the beginning of Bava Basra discusses who wrote the different books found in Tanakh, and it gives credit to the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly, as the writers of the prophecies of Yechezkel, Treyasar, Daniel, and the book of Esther. Sounds to me like Esther did not record this book. If you take a look at source number 8, the Talmud in Megillah, as a dialogue between Esther and the sages. Esther sent to the sages, record me for generations. And they sent to her, can't. There's a verse in Mishle, a verse in Proverbs, which says, have I not recorded for you Shalishim? Now, in context in Proverbs, that verse is talking about something completely different. It's talking about the Torah. And what it's saying is that God recorded the Torah to be like his noble officers, his shalishim. However, they take shalishim as a play on shalosh, or shlosha, three. Meaning the Torah is only recorded, or something is only recorded three times. And as commentators explain this passage in the Talmud, what it's saying is that the war against the nation of Amalek is only to be recorded three times. Only three. So what is three? Once in the Torah in Parashat Bishalach, once in the Torah in Parashat Ki Tetze, and then once more in Shmuel, even though there are other wars with Amalek. But not the Purim story. And then they said, no, wait, not so fast. Actually, Ketov Zod Zikaron Basefer, I'm not going through the passage here and all the exegesis involved, but the Talmud ends up saying, no, it's okay, we can actually do that. We can record it in this book of Esther separately. My point in bringing this right now is only to say that the Talmud seems to think that the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly in the beginning of the Second Beis HaMikdash, they're the ones who decided to write this down. Professor Nehemiah Cohn, in his introduction to the Book of Esther in the Dat Mikra edition of Esther, supports this, that it wasn't written by Esther, from the text itself. Tell me something. What do you see in the first sentence of the Book of Esther that tells you that it is unlikely that this was written by Esther herself? Opening sentence. Not so much. I mean, she would know as much as anybody would.
I think it's the way he's introduced, not as close to her, like it's somebody remote, because if it's her husband, she would have to discern it differently, maybe.
That's interesting. I mean, I don't know how close she felt to the man.
Sorry, it's almost the tense, the way it's saying, who Ahasuerus? Was that Ahasuerus? Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's written retro.
Right. It sounds like it's in as a retrospective, but even just the beginning, even before what you just pointed out, and it was in the days of Ahasuerus. If Esther wrote it, it's happening right now.
I learned that Mordechai wrote this book.
Well, right now we've got a candidate of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly. To be fair, Mordechai is potentially a member of that great assembly. There is somebody mentioned in Ezra by the name of Mordechai Bilshan among the Jews who came back and even led. It's in Nehemiah. Who led the Jews early in the Second Temple period. So there are those who suggest that Mordechai is Mordechai from the Purim story. He left Persia and came back eventually, just like Nehemiah had a royal position, and then he came to Israel. And if you accept that, he could be in this great assembly, which is fundamentally an Israeli body. So that's possible. But the way that the Talmud framed it in source number 8, it didn't sound like it. It sounded like they were a separate group. That would be the instinctive way to read it. Yes, Hannah.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Interesting. That letter made it everywhere, but the Megillah did not. Okay.
But there's something else too. The Ethiopians didn't celebrate anything after the Torah. No, they didn't celebrate Tami Festu. They fasted on that letter go to them.
That is interesting. I did not know that. Right, and that's the thing. And no, but bringing the Dead Sea Scrolls up, I think, is an important point. Because we know the Karaites rejected Hanukkah and Purim, saying that those are rabbinic and we don't trust rabbinic authority. And depending on whose school you take for who it was who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, no one says they're Karaites. That would be quite the anachronism. The Karaites aren't around for centuries. But the Essenes have their issues with what's called rabbinic Judaism, it's entirely possible that they don't buy into the stories of Hanukkah and Purim. I don't know. But I think that would explain that. In terms of the Ethiopians, I don't know how you explain someone not celebrating Purim but celebrating Tanit Esther. That sounds like somebody doing the first part of the Seder and stopping before the meal. Like, what'd you do that for? I don't know. That I don't know what to make of. Okay, all of this was introduction. Let's get into the book itself, because it's already 2:05 on our second session. Yes?
Oh, I just wanted to say that most of these rabbis, they didn't know the history anymore. They were living in Europe. They
Who are you talking about?
Century. Most of the commentaries that you read about, most of the people who decide when the book is written.
Back up. What do you mean? Which commentaries, because right now all we've got in terms of the, I mean, obviously you couldn't be here last week because of the Shiva, but the basis for figuring out when this happened is actually relatively straightforward historically. Go back to the audio from last week and you'll see, you know, that calculation. I don't see that any of this is contingent on rabbis living later. I go back to here last week's and then come back to me with it. Yeah. Okay. So, chapter one. So what I want to do with this chapter is understand the storyline, determine the message of particular events that happen in the chapter as seen via commentaries, midrashim, and so on, and apply the messages to grasp, again, the greater themes of the book. The structure of the chapter is fairly well known, but I put it on the sheet between sources 8 and 9. First 8 sentences, Ahasuerus throws the two parties we mentioned before. Then he gives his famous command to Vashti, although, as we'll find out, he never gave a command to Vashti. That's important. But you'll see, something is involving Vashti. She refuses to do what she's supposed to do. Ahasuerus looks for advice from his counselors, and the advice ends up being, yeah, you should get rid of her and let everybody know that your husband says do something, do it. And again, we'll talk about what the advice actually was and whether that was really the advice. And he issues decrees. That's your basic first chapter. So in terms of the themes of the chapter, what we're doing here is, first of all, establishing Ahasuerus as a figure in the story with personality traits that will play out throughout the book. A major theme here is the drive for power. And then an undercurrent in this chapter is chess pieces being moved into place before the game begins. The game hasn't actually started yet, but everybody is sort of taking their places on stage before everything is going to go. So Vashti is going to be gone. However, we need the backstory of how she's gone, because that affects our understanding of who Ahasuerus is and what he's trying to accomplish. That's got to be there. And and it's also going to frame Esther's relationship with Ahasuerus. So I need this. It's giving me necessary backstory. Big questions about this chapter. What are the big questions? I don't want the little questions about like a particular word here or there. But what big questions about the activities in this chapter do we ask? What are the real problems here?
The question of Ahasuerus and the kind of king he was and the role of his advisors.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
Well, he seems very influenced by those around him.
Yes. Right.
And then what to do, absolutely.
Right. He's very influenced by the people around him, for sure. I'd go earlier in the chapter for some big questions before the Vashti story. What's with all the party and the luxury?
And why does he have to show it off?
Who in the world throws a 6-month party telling everybody that you have to show up there? And not only that, the timing of the party is bizarre. What year of Ahasuerus' reign is it when he throws this party? Year 3. Why do you throw a party in year 3? I understand you throw a big inauguration. It's going to be the biggest inauguration that's ever been. No one ever had a bigger inauguration than I did. Like, that I can understand. I can understand if there's some kind of like, you've been on the throne for 20 years and you hit a milestone, so you're going to make a big party after 20 years. Who in the world throws a big party after year 3? It doesn't make any sense. Not only that, look at the way that it's introduced. When we have this party introduced to us, take a look at the opening chapter, sentence 2. By Amim Ahem, in those days, Kesheves Hamelach Achashverosh al Kisei Malchuso. When Achashverosh sat on his throne, Asher B'Shushan Habira, in the capital city of Shushan, Bishnas Shalosh L'Malchav Asamishteh, the third year of his reign, he made a party. Can you make up your mind about when this happened? No, 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 even aside from that, Nachon Ruchama, Aval Hashayla Shi Kodemet, when did this happen? Is it? But when he sat on his throne was year one. Three years of consolidation? Maybe. It's bizarre. The whole thing is bizarre. And then you get his reaction to her, to her not listening. Why did Achashverosh even think she was going to do whatever it was that he wanted her to do, which we have to talk about? The whole thing is so strange. Now, one thing I want to say, which I always say, and some of you are going to be very bored of hearing this from me, but you're going to hear it again, because it's got to be said at least once a year. We spend a lot of time, we already spent a lot of time in the introduction, reading Midrashim. It's very important to understand what a medrash is and what a medrash is not. By and large, I can't say this 100% of the time, but by and large, midrashim from the volumes that we are quoting, which is to say, from the Gemara and from Medrash Rabbah, most of Medrash Rabbah, are not simply made-up stories that somebody told in order to get a message across. The job of drash is to pay attention to language. The job of drash is to keep the text honest. In other words, pshat, when people say, just give me the pshat, tell me the straight story, ignores nuances of language. It just pretends that the problems and the anomalies aren't there. So if I read a pshat read of the opening sentences of the Megillah, I say, okay, Achashverosh reigns over 127 countries, and he is in Shushan, and the third year he makes a big party. Medrash says, not so fast. First, you have to explain, among other things, the answer to what we just asked before, of, was it when he sat on his throne, or was it year three? Because the two aren't the same thing. Medrash is going to have to address an opening question from the beginning of the book. Someone here in this room sent me an email shortly before the class saying, why does it say, and it was in the days of Achashverosh, he is Achashverosh who reigned from Hodu to Kush. Pshat reader just says, it was Achashverosh, this is Achashverosh. You could do that. But if you're serious about language, you want to know what that's about. What is it trying to tell me? The problem with Medrash, and what makes it frustrating for people, is that Medrash has no loyalty to plot. Medrash has no loyalty to storyline. It doesn't have loyalty to any particular message. You will get a Medrash from a sage explaining one thing that'll say one thing, and then he'll say something else on another chapter that will contradict it. Or, give a classic example, we already alluded to it last week, the text is going to talk about Achashverosh's party and about the vessels that he used at the party. And a Medrash is going to seize on the wording that's used to describe the vessels and say, those were the vessels that were taken from the first temple when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple. The problem is that everybody agrees that the events of Purim have to be after Cyrus already sent back all the vessels. And a text stresses in Ezra and in Divrei HaYamim that he actually sent back all the vessels. But the Medrash is not interested in that. That problem has to work itself out. Somehow he ended up with vessels. Maybe he went back to Israel and he got more vessels. Maybe there was a secret cache. Somehow or other, there were vessels. But it's just doing a textual analysis. So when we look at Medrash, what we're really doing is trying to look really closely at text and using the ears and the insights of the people who looked at text most closely and analyzed it in a way that took into consideration Tanakh as well as rabbinic writings and ideas. So we take Medrash, you know, fairly seriously with this. We're going to hold it, you know, to the text in the sense that you have to be responsible to the text and try to figure out where it's coming from. But where the Medrash is an incredible tool for analyzing what this book is actually trying to say.
Using the words of the text to elicit a message.
No, that's often true. That is very often true. There's an idea recorded in the Shilta Giborim in Maseches Avodah Zarah, which I brought in the beginning of our Medrash Rabbah series that we did a bunch of years back, in which he talks about the different purposes of Medrash, and definitely angling towards, okay, here's my text, here's my problem, how am I going to understand it? And angling towards the message you can get out of it is consistent with what Medrash does. Absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. And we're going to come back to that in the context of the vessel story. I'm looking at the time and realizing it's probably not going to be today, but it'll be next week. But it's already on the source sheets here where we're going to go with that and the messages that they're angling to get from it. So this party here. This party is a difficult story. We've already noticed some of the difficulties. I want to try to show three different approaches to what Ahasuerus was doing in this party. I am not going to bring every possible source, every possible commentator, every possible medrash. There is, to say it's a world of commentary on this would be an understatement. We're just going to try to see some things, because otherwise it will be 20 years that will be on the Book of Esther. I'm not kidding. There's just so much that's been done with this beautiful book. So, school number one regarding the Book of Esther, regarding Ahasuerus's party, is that this is simply a demonstration of Ahasuerus's obsession with power and status. Rabbi Meir Leibush Weiser, also known as Malbim, took that approach to this. And we're going to see some of his commentaries he wrote in the 18th century. But we'll see, Malbim loves language, and he always tries to show you, based on the language itself, where things are going. So we start in verse number 2. Even though there's stuff to say about verse number 1, we're going to start in verse number 2, in which he says, "Bayamim ha'heim, in those days, Kisheves Hamelach Achashverosh al Kise Malchuso Asher B'Shushan Habira, as Achashverosh sat on the throne of his kingdom in Shushan." Take a look at the Medrash I brought you in source number 9. The Medrash is bothered by a question I've already pointed out, right? The question of why is he sitting on his throne now? He's in year 3. What took him so long? So look at this Medrash. Rabbi Yehuda said, I'm just working from my English translation in the interests of time. Rabbi Yehuda said, in the third year of work on the throne, when the work on the throne was complete, in other words, he ordered a new throne. That's why he's not sitting in a throne until year 3. Why did he order a new throne? What was wrong with the old throne? So take a look. Nope, I'm bringing you Malbim first, Susan. Sorry. Take a look at... Yeah, that's what I don't want you to do. Thank you. I do want you to read it. I just don't want you to interject with it. Like I said, I'm not bringing the world and universe of things that could be said. Just trying to stick on point if I can, because that's hard for me. So take a look at source number 10. Look at what the Malbim says. Now it, the book, reports how immediately at the start of his reign, he grabbed hold to such an extent that his heart led him to alter the throne which had been in Babylon, moving it to Shushan and making Shushan the capital and royal city. Malbim is aware that the Babylonians and then Persians had multiple capitals. Babel, the term we use, Babel is actually the term for the capital city of the empire known as the Babylonian Empire. And he says, Ahasuerus is the one who moves the capital to Shushan, which we know to be true separately. So he says, the Achashverosh makes some changes. He has a new throne, and he has a new capital city. So it says, thus he showed his strength, thinking immediately to reign without limits to such an extent that he did not fear that his subjects would rebel against him for changing the royal throne. That's what he wants to show. Look how powerful I am. I moved the capital. I set up a new throne. And two, his greatness in power. That's what he wants to show. For when a regular person becomes king, it is his honor to sit on the throne of past kings, and not on a throne he makes for himself, which would actually reduce his honor, right? You say, I want to sit on the throne that Louis the whatever sat on, Henry the whatever sat on, right? I want to sit on Queen Victoria's throne. Like, you want to say, look at me, this is my status. But he exalted himself so much that he established a new throne for himself. It all begins with me. And it adds that he did not demonstrate this power after holding the throne for a long time, but immediately in those days, right away. So the way Malbim interprets what's going on, building on this Medrash in Esther Rabbah that says that there was a new throne, is that Achashverosh wants to show, look at me, look what I can get away with. I moved the royal capital, I set up a new throne, I don't need any of the people who came before me, and nobody can do anything about it. That's the idea. And he invites everybody. And here we get to sentence three. The third year of his reign, he made a feast for L'chol Sarav Va'avadav, Chel Paras Umadai HaPartimim V'Sarei HaMedinos L'Fanav. Now here we're going to get an insight, which, honestly, I have to tell you, I've been reading Megillas Esther all my life. When I say all my life, like, my bris was Purim. Like, I was, you know, I leaned Megillas Esther for my bar mitzvah. It was like, everything is this story. My name is Mordechai, right? And yet, until I saw Malbim on sentence three, I did not realize what I was reading in that sentence. Because you need someone to point out language to you. Look what he says. The third year of his reign, he made a feast for all of his nobles and all of his servants. The wealth of, or the forces of, Paras and Madai, the Partimim are some kind of noble, Visarei HaMedinos Lefanav, and the officers of the lands before him. Who is this cast of characters? Who are the invited guests for this feast?
Only men. It's a men's world.
Well, Vashti has her own party for the women.
Well, I understand.
But who are these people?
The people who are both beneath him. It's not for other kings and other rulers. It's for his servants, his army.
True, but something else.
People are going
to keep him in power is also true. Take a look at Malbim. Just because we're running out of time, I want to show this to you because this blew my mind when Malbim did this. This is the sort of thing that Malbim can do. With the attention he pays to things that nobody else is watching. He says, in order to realize this desire of his for his reign to be unlimited, he acted cleverly in the third year of his monarchy, which he planned to reign upon with a mighty hand. So it says, Malchuso, it's his reign, right? That's the emphasis in the text. He made a party so that he could establish his heart's plot at this party. And immediately, in the order of those invited, he demonstrated his goal. First, he put his nobles, his servants, Sarav Va'avadav, and the armies of Persia and Media, Chel Paras Umadai. First he has my people, the people who work for me, and my army. And after them, I added the bold, he seated the partimim, the nobles, and the officers of the lands who had been officers before him, meaning before he conquered those kingdoms, lefanav, chronologically lefanav. All the people who had been officers before he came to power. First he invites and he seats the people who are his people. Then he invites all the people who were still there from the previous administration. You follow? Thus he showed he didn't consider himself appointed at their will and desire. For then the nobles of the great lands would have preceded the nobles of the small land where he reigned first, and certainly his servants and the soldiers of the army. He says, I'm not interested in putting everybody else's people, the people from the last king, in here first. I want the people who are beholden to me first. It's a strategy. It's a power play. And I leaned this, I don't know how many gazillion times and never noticed it. It's like I said, you have to learn Malbim, because Malbim sees things that nobody else sees. But yeah. Well, right. We don't know if he does it on his own, but you're right that it doesn't mention him consulting anybody. This seems to be, you know, we go out of our way in other places in the text to emphasize when he consults. And we don't say anything about him consulting here. So I think that's a valid point. We have to come back to that when we see him consult others. How does he decide when to ask, and how does he decide when to do something apparently himself? The other thing that goes along with this, though, is what we said earlier about him being a schemer. Right? Who is he going to invite first? The locals first, or the people from the other lands? And we saw the Gemara read that in two different ways. What's particularly interesting to me is source number 11. Last year, we learned about Sanherib, the king of Assyria, and how Sanherib invaded first the northern kingdom of Israel, exiled the 10 tribes, and then eventually he invaded the southern kingdom of Yehuda, of Judea. And he made a pitch through Rav Shakeh, his servant. He said, guys, you can't defeat me, so make this easy. Surrender to me, and everything will be fine. I'm going to send you off to a land like your own, a land with figs and grapevines, and it'll all be good. It'd be just like you were home. That's the sales pitch from Sanherib. And of course, Chizkiyahu rejects his push, and he invades and is miraculously defeated at Yerushalayim. Hang on, Gita, because it's 2:29. Sorry. So source number 11 has the same comment as we made about Achashverosh. Rav and Shmuel debated. One said he was a wise king. This is talking about Sanherib. The other said he was a foolish king. If he was a wise king, he thought, if I tell them it's better than your land, they'll say I'm lying. Sanherib said, I'm going to take you to a land that's like your land, because he felt otherwise they won't believe me. If I say it's better, they're not going to believe me. So it was a smart strategy. Or he was a foolish king. Because if the two lands are equal, then why should they bother going? Leave aside the question of those two strategies and their relative benefits. The point out of this is that the Gemara is trying to do something by linking Sanherib and Achashverosh as schemers. I would suggest what it's trying to do is that it's trying to depict the two of them as the same. Sanherib is depicted in Tanakh as an arrogant blowhard. He claims no god is able to defeat him, and then he's routed at Jerusalem. And maybe that's the point. It's a statement that the Talmud is trying to make, that Achashverosh is the same. He's arrogant, he makes an awful lot of noise, and at the end of the day, he's going to get taken down. I don't know. There's more to be said about the Achashverosh Sanherib parallels, but realistically, we're going to need to pause here. But what we're starting to see is the most basic read of Achashverosh's party, which is he is going to make his big party to impress everybody, show them just how powerful he is. And what I want to do next week is see two other ways to read this party, and then move on to the Vashti Achashverosh relationship and ask how we are supposed to understand what's going on there. So thank you very much. Gita, what did you want to say? Well, they're not kings before him. They're nobles in all these 127 lands.
But he's outlived them, but he's outpowered them in a way.
Right. Yeah, I think he is trying to demonstrate that. Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, childish, but okay.
Hey, that's the name of the game here.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes. But it's his avadim. It's his avadim, his servants. What status do they have?
Does servants have to mean servants, or could it mean...
Who else would it mean? If they're nobles, it already said sarav.
Okay.
So I don't know who else they would be. All right. Thank you very much.